Welcome to Beyond Barbarossa, the first English language podcast in the world that focuses on the Eastern Front of World War II. I'm your host, Scott Burry. I'm podcasting to you today from the new Redbeard studio on traditional Algonquin Anishinaabe territory, also called Ottawa, Canada. And I'm thrilled to bring back my guest, the author who also focuses on the Eastern Front, Dr. David Stahl of the University of New South Wales in Canberra, Australia. We started our conversation in the episode you heard last week. So last week, David Stahl explained that he didn't really see studying the Eastern Front of the Second World War as a specialization because he sees himself studying and written about the war in Europe, which was mostly fought on the Eastern Front. The numbers of people and equipment and weapons and ammunition and casualties all show that very clearly. It was fought on the Eastern Front. It was not just one of many areas of operations and of conflict. And as he put it, if you were a German soldier in the Wehrmacht, the German army, in 1941, you probably were serving on the Eastern Front. It was the default setting. Now, David also told us that what drew him, what sparked his interest in this side of things was the scale of the war in the East, the numbers of men and weapons and so on involved. 150 German divisions alone, he pointed out. And also the geographic scale, the sheer distances involved. This interest led David to move to Germany for 10 years, where he dove deep into the warehouses of documents, the daily reports from those 150 divisions. And this initial research led to his first book, Operation Barbarossa and Germany's Defeat in the East. And last week, he posed the question that drove his research, what he came to ask as he read report after report. If the German army was so awesome, was this armored juggernaut wiping out the Red Army? Where's their victory? So where we left off last week was David's description of some of the facts that surprised him, that he found as he dove into those documents. The realities of supply and logistics that, as he put it, undercut the German invasion, that were not the Red Army. The difficulties of transporting necessary supplies, not just of ammunition and people and food, but also of spare parts for hundreds of different kinds of vehicles. And the story he left us with last week about how in August 1941, so this is less than 2 months into the invasion, in a war that would last for 4 years, hurrying Heinz Guderian, commander of Panzer Group 2, asked for hundreds of replacement engines for his tanks, which the factories just didn't have because they didn't make more engines than tanks. It's one engine per tank. This story is emblematic of the challenge the Germans learned to face, the vast numbers and distances, which led me to the big question, which I think all of us listeners, all of us history buffs who aren't necessarily professional historians are wondering about and want to ask. So I put this big question to David Stahl. Your first book concluded that Operation Barbarossa failed essentially in August 1941 because Hitler decided to divert Panzer Groups 2 and 3, which had been in the center driving toward Moscow, respectively, south and north to Kiev and Leningrad. So that leads me to my big question. And I know hindsight is 2020. I know it's impossible to really look at hypotheticals. But if Hitler had not made that decision, if the Germans had continued focusing on Moscow in August 1941, kept Panzer Groups 2 and 3 in the center, could they have succeeded?
Yeah, sure. I think that's one of the great sort of what-ifs of 1941. And I mean, you're also correct. We only know what happened. But if we explore that hypothetical, I think there are some very big questions that there's simply no answers to in any of the files. Like, we know that they will subsequently, after the Battle of Kiev, push on at the end of September with Operation Typhoon. So a lot of
Right.
people say, oh, that would have just been the continuation, but it wouldn't have been the continuation in August for two key reasons. One, I talked before about the reconditioning of the tanks and the needs for these engines and all of that. That's happening in that interim period. While some tanks are off doing Guderian's drive to the south and so on, they are desperately trying to get supplies forward for this reconditioning. And that's still happening with Hermann Hoth and so on, although he's lost one of his Panzer Corps to go up to the north, exactly as you say. The other thing that's happening is the armies in the center are fighting a tooth and nail battle against Soviets. Soviets are really pushing at them, and they are straining to hold the Ninth Army in particular. And they have some real crises there. We don't really talk about it very much because people don't really research the individual histories of specific armies. But they are, if we just said, oh, why wouldn't they just drive through? What's actually happening is a lot of Soviet reserves are being basically destroyed on Soviet on German defensive lines. The Soviets, on the one hand, are desperately trying to drive into the German forces, and they're really straining at the bit. I mean, there's points at which in Boxtiere, he's the commander of Army Group Center, that he's fearful that the whole thing's just going to collapse. It's not just a few local offensives. They are serious attacks. And the Germans would otherwise have to drive into this. And the other problem that they're going to have for doing that is resources. They are trying desperately to extend the rail supply up to the furthest point of the German advance. Without that rail supply, everything depends on a truck. And the trucks, for reasons we discussed before about the utility of these trucks, they're breaking down all the time. And the aggregate sum total of a truck's content is actually the greater the distance from the railhead, less and less, because it has to consume its own resources. In other words, how much
Right.
fuel does a truck have? Not enough to drive hundreds of kilometers, especially when you're very low gear, sandy roads. It's not always straight lines. They're having to go
No.
around burnt out villages and things. Detours, all the rest of it, partisan areas and so on, because a lot of captured Soviet, sorry, not captured Soviet troops. They're not really partisans, but they're operating in the rear.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of delays there, and the trucks just aren't the solution. They know that. They know that before the war. But the problem is the scale, the gauge is different, as I'm sure many of your readers would know. The gauge is different in the
Yeah.
Soviet Union, and therefore they're having to change that gauge. Now, initially, the Germans, they always seem to plan on a very optimistic basis. Hey, this is super simple. The gauge is different. We know that. You just put the pins up, right? Very simple process. Push them closer together, nail the pins back down again, and the trains run. There's no problem with doing this conversion process. That's what they plan for. Except for the reality in the East is two things have been happening. One, the Soviets are very good at destroying all their own infrastructure. Scorched earth is a reality. The other thing is a lot of the destruction is caused by the Luftwaffe. While this is still in enemy territory, they've been bombing trains and it's destroying everything. And then these conversion troops get there and say, we need everything. We need
Yeah,
the
we
whole
need new
thing
rails,
needs to be rebuilt.
cars. Yeah.
Exactly. The whole thing. So there's just not the resourcing. In fact, they're very poorly resourced for managing that process. And they're very much second-rate troops without very good equipment and so on. And they're trying desperately to move that further forward to the front. Now, that's what's going to continue to happen right through the summer. And basically, by the time Typhoon begins, one of the reports I remember from one of the armies, I think it's the Fourth Army, Kluger's army, he says, look, we're only existing hand to mouth right now. There's nothing in reserve, right? Now, to launch an offensive, you need to have stockpiles. You're going to project yourself further to the east, hundreds of kilometers, and you need fuel, you need ammunition, you need food, you need all the rest of it.
Yeah.
And if they're living hand to mouth, and you can well imagine they are, they're trying to support, not just hundreds of thousands. They've got 3 million men in the east. There's a lot of supplies that need to come. They're only just reaching them, and then they're going to project themselves. And this is at the end of September. So two things are about to change. One is that they're about to launch themselves further, which they couldn't have just done in August. They just didn't have anything built in terms of infrastructure to support this. But two, the other thing that's going to change is the weather's about to change. And of course, when you start getting worse roads and so on, it just complicates the logistics again. Now, that's just talking about logistics. Let's just consider something else. It's a little difficult if people can't really visualize these things, but imagine in August, if we are seeing a bulge in the Eastern Front in the center, and that bulge exists because Army Group Center has overwhelming armored support, and they have projected themselves further to the east. And if the argument is, well, let's just keep driving on Moscow, from where they are at that point in August to Moscow is another 300 kilometers. And south of that is basically the central Ukraine. That hasn't been conquered. There are the single largest Soviet front, the Soviet Southwestern Front. It has five armies in it. That's all sitting there on the Dnieper Bend, right? And it is not going to be destroyed by Army Group South because they're really on the other side of that river and they haven't got the Panzer forces of the center. They've got Kleist's 1st Panzer Group, but it's smaller than Guderian's. You know, there would also be a question about just seizing Moscow itself. I think that's a whole separate discussion. You know, the Germans would need to bring an enormous amount of force to bear there, and that would be extremely dangerous if you have a very long, very exposed and very weak southern flank, as well as a northern flank by that point. So the virtue of clearing the flanks for all kinds of reasons, not to mention that the great success that the Battle of Kiev was, and the unlocking that does for the Donetsk and all of these resources that Germany will want, you know, I think it makes sense to ultimately do what they did. And and the alternative poses a lot of question about how would they sustain this both logistically and militarily.
Yeah, but so it seems then there's no right answer, right? Because if you divert and you protect the flanks, as you have to protect the flanks, right? You don't want to be exposed to the way they would have been. And yes, Kiev was this huge victory in terms of territory gained, resources gained, the numbers of Soviet soldiers captured, was it 700,000?
I mean,
staggering.
I was going to say, the German reporting, we have these figures, 650,000, I think, is their official figure. I've often asked people, how did they measure this, though? Is it done on a system of averages? Are they actually counting them? How do they actually get to these figures? You're right. It's a staggering victory, however you count it, right?
Yeah. And so they had to do that, but that diverted the forces away and slowed them down even more. But if they hadn't done that, then they would have been exposed. So it doesn't seem, the big question was it ever possible in any way for Germany to achieve that objective of taking Leningrad and Moscow and having the Soviet Union government, the communist government, fall? And that would give them Lebensraum.
Yeah, look, that's such a hard question to answer. Also because, counterfactuals are just by nature, aren't something you can't prove. But I don't know of any scenario, and it is fun to have those. I always try to steer my students away from it in the tutorials. No, come on, guys, let's stick to what happened. But I love those conversations at the cafe or the pub afterwards, where we can untangle all these, or just throw ideas out there. Look, I don't know of a solution. There are so many things that compromise what the Germans are trying to achieve. They're just endemic to the German army that there's not really. Even if we started earlier and said, okay, we're not in late August, we're in 22nd of June, or even go back a year before that and say, you can plan your own camp. What else do we do? There's not a whole lot of reserves that Germany has. Mm-hmm. And the reality of the war that they're fighting, especially if you factor in things like, maybe to tie it right to the very beginning of this discussion where we talked about war of annihilation, when you start fighting a war like that, perhaps that's what we're seeing very much now with the Russians in Ukraine. When you start fighting a war like that, you get an entirely different response on the other side. And if the idea of military action is to compel your enemy to stop fighting or to give up, one of the things I think that the Nazis are doing there is they are setting everyone up against them. It almost doesn't matter whether you like Stalin or communism or his brand of communism. It doesn't matter at all. It doesn't even matter if you care for a Soviet state, as maybe Georgians may not, or people in the Baltic states or Ukrainians might not. at the end of the day, it's going to be better than what the Nazis are offering when one gets an idea of what they actually offer. And that's not something that's clear to Soviet citizens before the war, because, you know, German occupation in the First World War, well, wasn't all that bad necessarily. And there's a lot of history there with the Bolsheviks coming on the scene and doing yes. horrendous things. So it couldn't be worse, could it? Except a couple of months in, it starts to become quite clear, oh no, it's much worse. They are wholesale mass murdering people. And yes, they're mass murdering Jews, but you don't have to be a Jew to be a target if you happen to be live in an area that's partisan rich, or you know, you're just a Soviet soldier, a Russian, whatever, captured. These guys are discovering what's happening behind the lines, you know, mass murder of POWs, yes. not because they're necessarily shooting them, the starvation, it's the same end, right? Whether someone's lining up against a wall or just starving you to death, it's still horrendous. And as that filters back, and it does filter back, it suddenly becomes apparent to people, and we know this by about sort of people, not me doing these kinds of studies, but people who've done these things on Soviet civilian or Soviet military, you know, what do they really think? It's not just because propaganda hits you that you think that way. It's because propaganda tells you one thing, and it turns out what a lot of these studies confirm is when you're in the breadline or when you're in the ranks, if the guy next to you tells you it's exactly the way the propaganda is telling it, that's what you actually believe. Then you see that alignment and you start believing it.
That's a very telling analysis, especially these days. But right now, let's take a short break.
Did you know that the cappuccino was invented by a Ukrainian? Or that many first names, like Philip and Agatha, were brought to Western Europe by Ukrainian princesses? Or that a Ukrainian was the first female given the rank of officer in a modern army? Well, if you didn't, and even if you did, you can learn more about my podcast, Wandering the Edge, a podcast about Ukrainian history with a spot of travel. And all in English. And if you like Beyond Barbarossa as much as I do, because, well, it makes my life a whole lot easier since I don't have to do any episodes deep diving into the Eastern Front of the Second World War, please take a listen to Wandering the Edge for a deep dive into Ukrainian history, culture, and traditions. Find out more on wanderingtheedge.net. And now let's get back to Scott exploring and explaining the Eastern Front of the Second World War.
And I'm back with Dr. David Stahl, author of several books on the Second World War in Europe, and his contention that the war in the East, that is the Eastern Front, was not a specialization, but that's just where most of the Second World War in Europe was happening.
Do you think that any of Germany's professional soldiering class, either the very senior commanders or maybe the next level down, did they actually believe they could achieve those objectives? Or were they just, you know, trying not to incur Hitler's wrath?
Yeah, no, I think that there's a lot of self-belief. And even where, I mean, there's two things going on here, at least as far as I can see it. On the one hand, they have professional training. These are general staff officers. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? If you go right back to the 19th century, they're codifying the military experience. They're making it mathematical. They want to, so X number of men, X number of provisions, X number of tonnage, X number of vehicles. They're military professionals and they do that. Now, if you go through the Barbarossa planning, a lot of that staff work is quite good. That is pointing to big problems. The problem is the human component. So they see, hey, we need to have this many. I mean, Wagner is one of these guys and he says, you know, we're only going to be able to sustain basically half the number of guys to get to the Dnieper rivers, which is about 300-400 kilometers in. And after that, we can't really project ourselves much further, not in any real way. And that's because he's following staff work, and it's probably people under him doing that staff work. These are intelligent guys. You don't get into the general staff without being a cut above. So congratulations, they're very good at what they do, and they're doing the staff work, and they're the numbers, and they're the reports. It's what do you do with all of that? And that's where you start to see people like Helder, who is the chief of the Army General Staff in the planning phases, and he is seeing some of these figures. He is getting some of this, but what does he do? Does he say, Hitler, we're not going to be able to do this. This is just not going to work the way you think it is. His idea is no. Well, there'll be all these big border battles. That'll be difficult, but that's where we project ourselves into the east and crush those Soviet armies on the borders. And then we'll basically, well, we'll just figure it out then. We'll just drive into the east because there'll be nothing really to oppose us. That's a very optimistic assessment of how this might go. And
And it
if you
doesn't
do.
take into account the reserves that the Soviets had and the armies, in eastern Russia or Siberia in the Far East
100%.
that
That's
they
right.
then
It's
brought in.
yeah, that's right. They're not, they haven't, they've only got 2.7 million guys in the Western military districts. That's still a hell of a lot of people, right? But the capacity for mobilization, they've got a 14 million man mobilization pool, and those will take time to get there. And that's basically what we see at the Battle of Smolensk. The Germans kind of think the big border battles are over, and they've just got to try to almost encircle Smolensk. We've almost done it. And then there's almost this shock of where are these guys coming from the east? Who are those guys? But they're trying to break into the encirclement, but these are the second echelon that are basically being formed up around Moscow, around other cities further east, because you get mobilized in your district. And then once you're mobilized and you've got your weapons and you've got everything, it takes time. And then you get sent to the front. And that's basically what the Germans are encountering. It's odd that they don't foresee that, but
Yes,
that's the
that's the
nature
question.
of.
Like, what was it? They have these models, they have this mathematical model of how to conduct a war. But it seems that somehow a large amount of very crucial data didn't get put into those equations.
Well, that it could be that there's not that data put in there. That's I'd say that's also true of certain areas. There's also a very real human element where even when they're being presented with the problem, there's a tendency to look past that. And I think there's two explanations for why they're seeing past it. One could be National socialism. There is a national socialist worldview. Now, you might say, hang on, generals, I get it if you're a 13-year-old, or maybe at that stage, an 18-year-old who's been his whole life in a national socialist education and believes, absurd things. Oh, I'm just naturally better than everyone because I'm German. Okay, I get that. But how does a German general who is much older, he's not gone through this, he would have been formed, but there were still problems in the German military culture surrounding ideas of how best to put it, what Hitler calls the primacy of will. This isn't a Hitler concept. This predated National Socialism. The Germans used to call it Siegeswille or Kampfgeist or something like this, where the spirit, a good commander takes his men and he goes into battle. And he dictates terms to the enemy, right? You can't be this weak-willed guy who I'm not sure, maybe we're going to do this, maybe we won't do it. Oh, okay. Think about all that. You've got to be that kind of leader. And this goes back to Citino's work when he looks at the German way of war and he's sort of saying, look, Germans as a country in the middle of Europe, surrounded by potential enemies, had to end wars fast. So the culture had to be decisive battle, had to seek battle. We don't just, wait for the enemy to come on. We go and dictate the Vernichtungsschlacht, the war of another. The Battle of the Annihilation, right? We have to dictate these terms, and we need those kinds of commanders, and that has to be German military culture. Because if we don't, the guys on the other end of the country will attack us because we always face two front wars. So if that's already part of the culture, and then you're in the Wehrmacht, which is a hyper sort of masculine world and very national socialist. What does Hitler say in all those speeches? It's always about him. It's always about, oh, I changed Germany, right? And that's the kind of officer he looks to, and this is the kind of guy who's going to have a great career. Because if you're the sort of person in the Wehrmacht who says, I don't know if we can do this. No, I don't think we can do it. And for good reasons. Let me talk to you about the vehicles and the fuel and the consumption. Excuse me, let's just get someone in here who's actually going to be able to do this. And then if you have someone who just says, yes, mein Führer, I will get that objective. In fact, I will drive beyond it. This is the man we needed. That other guy, who was he? And they know this. So there's a real problem. And maybe this is true of definitely the summer of 1941, but I think you see it much clearer in the autumn and even into the winter, where they are not able to say these things. They know that they're in real trouble, but there's this cultural For example, Guderian's writing letters to his wife, because I've got all the letters, and he's saying things like, this is a huge problem, and no one's telling them this, and no one's telling them that. Well, the question you would have is, you're a Panzer commander, you have authority, why aren't you saying it? But he knows he can't, because I am exactly that. I'm the great Panzer commander, I'm the decisive one, I'm the one who's achieved all these victories. That's exactly how he sells himself in propaganda. That's exactly how he sells himself, because he's got a propaganda company attached to his Panzer group. So he's very much the guy on TV, in the sense of the Wochenschau and so on. He's out there, he's that go-getter guy, and he's expecting everyone else to do that work. Oh God, why is no one passing on that we can't do this stuff? But that's the problem, is they're all thinking this way, and no one wants to undermine their career by being that doubter, that cannot do guy. But that's cultural.
But it's cultural, but it also seems to be very much something in Guderian's case he created. He created a monster. The image he created himself kind of really mired him in this position that I am the ultimate Panzer commander. I said, let's mechanize everything. Everything will be in Panzers, and it will be unstoppable. And then he arrives at Tula with what, 12 tanks left or something like that.
Well, that's another interesting point, and you're absolutely right. He does get that. And I think to people hearing what you say, they'll say, yeah, tanks drive things forward. That's right. That's what we learned from the Germans. But the interesting thing is, and this is nothing I can quantify, but just as an observation, when I went through his letters, I think there's like 33, 34 letters we've got from the second half of 1941. I actually bothered to count, because once you've got them all into a computer, you can just do a word search. How many references does he ever make to logistics, supply? I can't remember off the top of my head, but it's like 6 or 7 or something, where he writes to his wife saying, oh, supply is a goddamn problem. Whatever, I can't find nothing. Or just looking for, how often does he mention fuel? How much does he mention ammunition? And he's often talking about, because he likes to talk about a lot of the military stuff, this guy's not letting me do this, this guy's not doing that, and complaining about the other commanders. But does he really understand, and he's only one man, but does he really understand what drives him forward? In other words, it's as important how many tanks you've got and how much ammunition you've got as it is how much fuel you've got, or how many trucks are coming with provisions for the men, or how much medical supply. That's as important. And I think modern day commanders get that it's a holistic situation. And there's not, therefore, and actually that's part of the culture that I read in McGargy's books, that if you're the operations officer, number one, if you're the logistics officer, geez, how did you, you mustn't be very good. You got into that. And intelligence is there. Now that's just completely absurd. They need them just the same as they need everyone else, but everyone wants to be in operations.
Everybody wants to be the guy standing, half out of the tank turret, right? With the field glasses. Okay, well, we're running short on time, so I'm just going to ask one more question. What is the main lesson that you think we can draw today from Operation Barbarossa?
When you say today, do you mean in context of like modern war and what's happening in Ukraine or so on, or do you mean about that period itself?
I'm tempted to say let's look at Ukraine in 2023, but no, I think that let's say we get to the 1945 from that perspective, and you look back, and it's been 4 years of hell. What is the big lesson, I guess, that we should draw from that?
I would say perhaps the one thing I am struck by when I study all of this German operations is hubris, right? This belief, this megalomaniac belief almost. I mean, you look at the size of the Soviet Union. Why don't we invade and attack that? But even if you just look at, U-boat operations, U-boats are going into the South Atlantic. Then you look on a global map and think, how far is that? How far could these things go? And the idea that they're going to project warfare onto such a scale, that just strikes me as, it's not surprising when I think Hitler thinks that way. But again, our earlier conversation, these are military professionals. Australia is a big country, and some of our guys complain to me about, oh God, they're going to move this base to here. And in a modern age, with all our modern sophisticated infrastructure and our armies,
good highways.
Not that big, good highways and rail and things like this. And they're saying, well, it's going to be a hell of a lot of work. Now, in context of an active global war against multiple major powers. You've taken on the Chinese, you've taken on the Russians, you've taken on the Americans, you've taken on the British, you've taken on what's left of the French, and all their constituent colonies as little old Germany. And okay, yes, they had a lot of success early on, but a lot of it strikes me as hubris to start this, to continue it. And maybe also feeding into your earlier question, how much did those German generals believe in this? They're not writing in their private wartime diaries, such as we have them, this is all going to end in disaster. There's absolutely no way we're going to win this thing. Even if we have short-term military success, economically, how do we square this circle? How do we go on like this? Where's the end point? And that's just, you know, that's not how it's seen in decades after the war. Decades after the war, we wrote for years these histories of, oh, the Germans are carrying all before them, oh, and therefore turning points were, you know, these knife-edge battles at Stalingrad and so on. Mm-hmm. Not really, not in my conception. It's, yeah, whether they get the last October factory or whatever is irrelevant. This thing is going to be decided by macroeconomic and population factors. And how come the German generals don't see it? And maybe even subsequently, how come historians for decades afterwards didn't see it? Now, in fairness, we've had a lot of really good studies done. And a lot of those really good studies have come in the last few decades that have really illuminated various parts to put it all together and say, oh yeah, this was going to be deeply problematic. But it also underlines why doing operational history today, you know, if you've got any PhD students listening to these kinds of things, is really exciting, because I think anecdotally people think, oh, the war's been worked out. I mean, what are you guys still writing about? But don't you know Germany lost? But actually that story is a real evolution, and we've only relatively recently gotten a lot of the constituent parts. I'm also convinced there's whole areas out there. We talked about logistics. There is no single history of logistics on the Eastern Front. Someone should go out there and write a book about trains and trucks, you know? Could be fascinating what we still discover. So,
well, the trains and trucks and horses, that was what my father-in-law emphasized a lot. And they had the whole, you know, either you put the rails together or you, what they did a lot of was, you know, unload a train and load everything onto the next, you know, with the larger units. And he told me about a few operations that he did where they messed that up quite a lot. Just simply as simple as you change the destination cards on the boxcars, right? And I thought, and when he first told me this, I thought, oh, yeah, big deal. Yeah, schoolboy prank. You snuck into the rail yard, you change these things around. And then I read in Enemy at the Gates about a big shipment that they got, that Paulus received in Stalingrad, of condoms. Thanks, not what we were waiting for, but thanks. But glad you're thinking of us.
I was going to say, and how about some ammunition or some heating fuel or something, or food?
God. These things, the logistics really make a difference. The other thing is, the mechanized army. There were a lot of horses, So anyway,
indeed.
But I think, the time is really running short. So I want to thank you very, very much, David, for agreeing to come on here.
No worries. Thanks, mate.
Take care. Bye-bye.
So I just want to say one more thank you to Dr. David Stahl of the University of New South Wales in Canberra, Australia. Thank you again for your gripping and highly informative conversation with me. And I hope to bring you back yet again at some point, maybe after we get to Stalingrad, narratively, not literally. And thank all of you history buffs for listening to Beyond Barbarossa, the podcast about the Eastern Front of the Second World War. To find previous episodes of Beyond Barbarossa, visit the website beyondbarbarossa.ca or beyondbarbarossa.podbean.com, where you'll find maps and historical photos, and as well, all the links to books and other sources, like David Stahl's books. You can also listen to the episode on my own website, writtenword.ca, and click on the podcast button in the banner. I want to also thank all who have supported the podcast through Patreon. As I've said, until all Ukrainian refugees can return home safely, your financial support goes to charities that help Ukrainian refugees. You can find the link to the Patreon page on the beyondbarbarossa.ca page. It's at the top. The link's at the top. If you like this episode, please consider following Beyond Barbarossa on your preferred podcasting app. I'd really appreciate a rating on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Those really help spread the word to others who are interested in this subject. As always, if you find I've made any errors, please let me know. You can reach me by email at contact@beyondbarbarossa.ca or through the Facebook Beyond Barbarossa page. Original music was composed and recorded by Nicholas Bury. I'm Scott Bury. Until next episode, keep your paddles in the water. Slava Ukraina.